I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. If the media is, as President Trump repeatedly asserts, dishonest, then who are the honest brokers of news and information? Is it anyone other than the president himself? If the media presents facts and the administration presents alternative facts, what are consumers of news to make of all that? Last May, Lewis Wallace was hired as a reporter for Public Radio's Marketplace. He is transgender, and he was hired in a program promoting diversity. Last month, he wrote a blog post about objectivity and diversity in the media. It led to Marketplace firing him for allegedly breaking its code of ethics. Lewis Wallace is my guest today, along with Laura Hazard Owen of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. Is objectivity in journalism dead? Midday starts right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday on this balmy spring afternoon here in Baltimore. It's currently 59 degrees here in downtown Baltimore, on its way to probably a record-breaking temperature, perhaps as high as 70. So enjoy it while it lasts, because we may have snow over the weekend. President Donald Trump makes no secret of the fact that he loathes the mainstream media. The president routinely calls outlets like CNN and the New York Times fake news. Senior advisor Stephen Bannon called the media the opposition party and urged it to keep its mouth shut. Another senior advisor, Kellyanne Conway, famously invoked the validity of alternative facts when pressed about inaccurate statements made by the president. So are we in a post-fact era, as some have suggested? Does journalistic objectivity and neutrality mean something different with this president in this highly segmented media landscape? And how are the notions of objectivity and impartiality informed by journalists who are more diverse than ever before? Is the purpose of journalism, first and foremost, truth-telling? Does that include contextualizing someone's statements or assertions, or does it mean simply reporting what a person says? If a reporter does provide context, does she risk crossing the line between journalism and activism? In an age where many people choose to get their news from places that validate their particular point of view, how does one tell what may be understood to be the objective truth? Late last month, objectivity was the subject of an essay on the website Medium.com by a journalist named Lewis Wallace. He entitled his piece, "Objectivity is Dead, and I'm Okay with It." Publishing the post set off a chain of events that led to Wallace being fired from his job as a reporter for American Public Media's Marketplace, a program that airs here on WYPR. But it also put a spotlight on a conversation newsrooms across the country are having about the particular challenges of covering a president who continues to attempt to discredit the press, consistently pitting himself and his supporters against the media. Lewis Wallace joins me today from the Argo Studios in New York. Mr. Wallace, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Also joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts is Laura Hazard Owen. She's the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. Ms. Hazard Owen, welcome.
Thank you.
You are welcome to join our conversation as well. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. So, Lewis Wallace, tell us what happened. You were working for Marketplace, you were hired there last May, and then how did that all come to an end?
Yeah, so I had been a reporter in the newsroom a lot of the time working on daily news, focused on economic stories, making them relevant and accessible and fun for our audiences. An aspect of my job at a couple points had been, you know, to kind of have an online presence in general, and in particular to write on a blog on Medium, which is just a blogging platform. Some of the things I wrote about were kind of reports from the field as I was out doing my journalism, and a little bit of like self-reflection and analysis on the work I was doing, what it was like to be a transgender journalist from my particular position is one thing that I'd written about before. After the election, and in particular after the inauguration, I think anyone working in news can attest that it's been a fairly chaotic environment, and a lot of our assumptions about how we should be doing our work have been challenged, and it's been really hard not to feel like you're just sort of chasing after Trump statements and spending a lot of time like fact-checking and debunking and that kind of stuff. And so I wrote a blog post for Medium that was a reflection on where we are in this moment and how sort of traditional ideas of objectivity and neutrality might not be serving us anymore, that an abundance of caution about appearing neutral might actually be preventing us from kind of telling the truth and calling things how they are with this administration, and us being sort of the mainstream media in general, not it wasn't like a call out of Marketplace per se. And then I talked in that same blog post about how, you know, for me, neutrality has always been kind of a complicated concept that I never really fully bought into as a transgender person, kind of knowing that there are certain issues that I can't really afford to be neutral on. So if the framing of the debate is, you know, whether or not I have a right to exist or use a bathroom or be in a public space, that's not something where neutrality really works. And my perspective on that is that no one can really be fully neutral, and that it's our job as journalists to kind of analyze and assess that and still try to tell the truth and do fair, good reporting that, you know, that investigates corruption and kind of calls out power. And I was feeling really excited about all of those issues and ideas and sort of the potential for journalists to really stand up in this moment and kind of fight back against the quote unquote post-fact world or, you know, ideas like alternative facts. After I posted that piece on my blog, I got a call from the managing editor and executive producer at Marketplace, and was suspended from my job on air doing daily news for a couple of days and told to take the post down. Initially, I did take it down, and the reason that I was asked to take it down was they said it was a violation of our ethics code, that it went too far in terms of sort of revealing my political stances and potentially putting Marketplace's credibility at risk. I ended up deciding that I disagreed really strongly with that analysis and felt I had been I was very surprised at the sort of punishment aspect of how I had been treated. And so I ended up deciding it was a very personal decision to put this blog post back up and requested a conversation with Marketplace about that and encouraged Marketplace to actually sort of take on some of the points that I'd made in more of a public way and, you know, potentially have another colleague or coworker of mine respond or rebut my points and sort of carry out that conversation in public, because I think people are really interested right now in how journalists are thinking about issues of neutrality and impartiality and how the Trump administration changes how we do our jobs and what we cover and what sort of the tone and approach of our coverage is, and how cool would it be to kind of carry on that conversation transparently as Marketplace and show people, you know, we're real people, we're thinking about this stuff, we know we're not perfect and we're trying to figure it out. And so that was the conversation that I asked for to take place publicly. A couple days later, I was fired without ever kind of having that follow-up conversation.
And did they point to anything in particular in the code of ethics that they use for all of their employees at Marketplace that you violated? I mean, the title, let me remind folks, the title of your essay originally was Objectivity is Dead and I'm Okay with It. So it would seem that an editor or producer at Marketplace might say, well, look, we have to be objective. We value objectivity, and we don't want our listeners thinking that we're not objective. I mean, how did they explain their particular position in this?
Yeah, well, I think there was a real concern about perception. The concern being that what I said would be perceived to sort of say we should throw impartiality towards political parties and politicians out the window. I think that was the primary concern, and sort of this idea that we shouldn't air anything on any platform that might suggest to people what our political leanings were. I had been very careful in the post that I wrote not to kind of weigh in on any policies or any individual politicians. And maybe sort of the irony there is that I actually agree that there should be a limit to that. I don't think of this as sort of a free-for-all, and I do a lot of policy stories, and I actually think it's really important to approach policy issues in a way that's extremely mindful to sort of considering all the arguments for and against and drilling down on the sources of those arguments and considering them as fairly as possible. And I think sort of the argument that I was making is just that we all bring, you know, biases and sort of perspectives even to that process. And that's not a new argument. That's something that, you know, people learn in journalism school and talk about in newsrooms all over the place. But my understanding is that the concern in terms of the ethics code was primarily one about perception, that we shouldn't say anything that could be perceived as politically partisan.
Lewis Wallace is a freelance journalist and former reporter for Marketplace. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We are also joined from Cambridge, Massachusetts, in her office at the Nieman School or the Nieman Institute, Laura Hazard Owen. She's the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. So Laura Hazard Owen, Nieman is one of the most respected institutes, or I don't know, how do you describe it? Is it a think tank? It's a place that journalism is thought about, written about, and advanced in various ways. How would you describe it to folks?
Yeah, so the Nieman Foundation here at Harvard, Harvard doesn't have a journalism school, but the Nieman Foundation does have a fellowship program that brings 24 fellows from around the world here each year for to study journalism and to do projects and to think about the environment that we are all working in as journalists. The Nieman Foundation puts out a publication called Nieman Reports 4 times a year, and I work at the Nieman Journalism Lab, which is a website out of the Nieman Foundation that is looking at the future of digital news.
And you published a piece in that publication, that web publication, about Lewis Wallace and the situation that he finds himself in with Marketplace. Do you agree with Lewis Wallace's contention that the traditional notions we have of neutrality and impartiality have changed and should change?
I do agree that they have changed and should change. I should note that that is my personal opinion, that I'm not necessarily speaking on behalf of everybody here at the foundation, because it is still a controversial question. But I would say that I do believe that journalists, I don't think it's actually possible for any journalist to be completely objective. I think there is no such thing, honestly, these days. I think that news organizations are recognizing, especially under the Trump administration, that there are new reporting methods that we need to do. The New York Times, for example, is devoting $5 million extra to covering the Trump administration. CNN and the Washington Post are beefing up their investigative reporting. There is a recognition that the Trump administration is different, that things have changed, that reporting might need to be a little more forceful, that we might be required to, for example, call out lies as lies when President Trump lies. And I think that although I believe that newsrooms have recognized that as being true, they have been slower to recognize that that their reporters, that the people working for them, may have a more difficult time being completely neutral as well.
We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and talk about a very complicated issue, which strikes me as being premised in some degree in the loaded terms that all of us are forced to use. When we talk about the Trump administration, for example, being different, we don't just mean different in that sort of dictionary sense. I think there's an implication there that we're not getting truthful information from people in the Trump administration, including the president himself. So we'll talk about what these terms like objectivity and neutrality mean to journalists and to the administration and to the consumer of news. Laura Hazard Owen is the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. Lewis Wallace is a freelance journalist and former reporter for Marketplace. You are welcome to join our conversation with them when we come back here on Midday. 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wypr.org. You want to drop us a tweet? Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Lots of fun talking about this very, very interesting topic. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're spending part of your day with us. Thank you so much. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, we dive into the agreement to reform the Baltimore Police Department. Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun, Ganesha Martin of the Baltimore Police Department, and Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition will join me to talk about the city's consent decree with the Department of Justice. The consent decree was signed during the final days of the Obama administration. So what will happen now with a new administration in Washington? How does the agreement purport to change the culture of policing in Baltimore? And what's its current status? That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about objectivity and neutrality in journalism with Lewis Wallace. He's a freelance journalist and former reporter for Marketplace. Last month, he wrote a piece for Medium.com called Objectivity is Dead, and I'm Okay with It. He joins us from New York. Laura Hazard Owen is the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. She's on the line with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You are welcome to be on the line with us as well. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Lewis Wallace, let me make sure folks understand. You had been specifically asked, as have many journalists for print and television and radio and publications, to maintain a personal blog. It's now required. It's a requirement of the job to tweet and post things to Facebook. They wanted you to have a personal blog to build what folks call your personal brand. Is that not the case?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, I think there's all the sort of political tensions of this moment around covering the Trump administration, and that's one aspect of this conversation. But I think in some ways that maybe the tensions of the shift to digital media are even sort of larger in driving this conversation, and like confusion about where objectivity and neutrality lie for us as journalists now, because there's such an appetite on the internet for a voice and kind of transparency, authenticity, perspective. Those are very much like the currency of the internet, and certainly on a blog, that's sort of all it is, right? You would read someone's blog because of who that person is, probably more so than anything else, and so you want to get to know that person. That creates a particular set of sort of challenges, I think, for those of us who are doing hard news journalism, where, you know, it remains true that there are a lot of traditional ideas, and some of those, I think, really good and necessary ideas around the ethics of how we cover our stories, that we don't come in and say, you know, I'm a Republican and here's my piece about this political issue or something like that. And I maintain that remains a good approach to our stories, and, you know, was never advocating that I should do a radio story about a policy or a politician where I made it into an opinion piece. But the world of blogging and Twitter and all of that is different, and you're sort of expected to have a personality, and I think transparency is like the currency there. And so that was where I think some of the surprise for me came, just in terms of the consequences and what happened with my employer. But more broadly, sort of looking forward, I think that's a tension that all kind of legacy media organizations are facing and are going to be facing even more, is how do you ask your hosts and reporters to have a voice and have a presence while also being in kind of a dynamic conversation about where the line is of sort of what we do say openly about ourselves. And I think some aspects of that for me are negotiable, right? And then there are others that are not, like my identity as a trans person sort of puts me in a position where, just in order to live and survive and be myself, I have to be sort of firm on certain things. And I think I've been very transparent about that just sort of throughout my life and in any job that I've had and stuff. But it gives me a particular perspective on like where sort of my moral and ethical lines are.
And Laura Hazard-Owen, this notion that people who are reporting stories are also tweeting things that, you know, can't help sometimes but be personal opinions. What do you think about that? Is that doing anything to attenuate the credibility of, you know, as we say, legacy journalist organizations? I mean, Andrew Ramsamy wrote a thing in also on Medium.com. And he says, while I can understand Marketplace's position to ultimately fire him, meaning Lewis Wallace, one can't look past a double standard given that their lead straight white male host reporter, Kai Ryssdal, repeatedly pushes the bounds of Marketplace's own publicly posted code of ethics through his own highly editorialized social media posts. You mentioned some of those posts in your piece. Where do you think about that?
Absolutely, yes. So I would argue that being on social media, having an active presence on Twitter, for example, is not really optional for a journalist, for most journalists these days, but it's something that news organizations expect and require as they are losing readers from, more traditional sources, that they need to find new audiences, and social media, Twitter and Facebook are one of the places where they do that. And so I think that there is an inherent conflict there. If you can't, you're not going to do well on social media if all you do is tweet out bland story links. You have to show a little bit of yourself there to build the kind of following that news organizations want their journalists to be building. And in fact, when I spoke to Marketplace, VP Deborah Clark and to Kai Ryssdal, the host that is being talked about in that post that you just mentioned, they spoke, Marketplace speaks favorably about Kai's Twitter account. He is definitely, fairly critical of Trump there. I think in many, many tweets you can see that. And it seemed as if that was considered a good thing by Marketplace, by Deborah Clark, who was the person who ultimately fired Lewis Wallace. And so I do wonder if there's a little bit of a double standard there, that if you've been working there for a long time, that if you're a big brand name, if you're more senior, if you're, perhaps if you're a white straight male, you have a little more room to say and do what you want on Twitter, and that employees who are more junior might not have that same ability to do that.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on that in a minute, but let me get to a tweet and a phone call that we have. Christopher Llewellyn Reed tweets, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, by the way, is a noted film historian and expert here in Baltimore. He's a university professor. He says, please ask your guest today how something that is true is not objective and vice versa. So Lewis Wallace, can something be true but not objective, or can something be objective and not true?
Yes, I love this question. So what I was making for Marketplace was stories, right? And so there's so much curation that goes into that, because you have like a set of facts and then you go beyond that because we're storytellers and we often do, kind of narrative and character driven work when we do feature stories. So I'm talking to people for, you know, many, many hours and cutting those many, many hours down into a 3 or 4 minute story. And so where I think the truth versus objectivity thing comes into play there is that, you know, of course, we assiduously fact check. We're very careful that everything that goes into our stories is verifiable, sort of based in reality. And at the same time, there's a very subjective process to curating, you know, which voices end up in that story, how the issues are framed, even just things like the order of the voices. And of course, most stories are about more than one thing. So, you know, if you have a story about a small business owner and the election outcome, I ended up doing a few stories sort of along those lines that are like both about people's sort of personal economic lives and how they feel about the outcome of the election, but also about other issues that came up in the election, like race, gender, identity, and sort of my own subjectivity in what questions I ask and then how I edit those stories down affects what the story ends up being. And so each story that I did for Marketplace or, you know, or for any other job I've had, I think was true, but was also like highly curated. And that's true of like any producer. It's not just me because I'm, you know, transgender or something like that. I think everybody's making those sorts of calls. And so, you know, I'm very interested in a more transparent conversation about how we make those decisions and what happens in newsrooms from the very beginning of sort of the assignment process to the analysis and framing that we bring to how we decide to report the story to what ends up in the final cut and what doesn't. And that's where I think I sort of stand by my admittedly clickbaity headline of, you know, that objectivity is dead and I'm okay with it. I don't think that's an objective process. I think it's very subjective for everyone, and that the more sort of diversity, creativity, and transparency that we put into that process, the more trust we have the potential to build with our audiences.
Lewis Wallace is a freelance journalist and former reporter for Marketplace. He joins us on the line from New York. Laura Hazard Owen is the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab of Harvard University. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Ray in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Laura Hazard Owen and Lewis Wallace. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. I have a comment I'd like to hear from your panel. In a democratic society where freedom of the speech is guaranteed and maybe freedom of press, and Donald Trump evidently has declared war on the media, isn't that committing political suicide on his part? I've always heard that the pen is mightier than the sword. I'd like to hear your panel's comment on that.
Well, thank you for your call, Ray. I appreciate it. Laura Hazard Owen, to date, you know, 3 weeks into the administration and after an election that he won, it doesn't seem that Mr. Trump's disdain for the media has cost him any support whatsoever among people who are inclined to support him.
It may not have cost him approval among people who are already inclined to support him, but I think, you know, I think that we see in his approval ratings that there's a lot of uncertainty about you know, the job that he's doing so far. And I think that all we can really do about that as journalists is to just kind of ignore the bluster and just keep reporting and doing our jobs. As I mentioned, you know, big news organizations are devoting more money, more resources to this. And ultimately, you know, I think that the way that we report on this administration is just to vigorously report on it, to keep doing our jobs.
I'm glad you make that point, because when people mention the disdain that Mr. Trump has for the media, my reaction is, well, who cares? I mean, it doesn't matter that he doesn't like us. I mean, we're not you know, here to become roommates. We're here to become, you know, to do our part in the process of democracy. So I'm glad you made that point. Paul in Garrett County, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yes, I'm 58, and I'm interested in a historical perspective here. I remember the Reagan administration when ketchup was a vegetable, and one could raise defense spending and cut taxes and balance the budget, and yet we survived that. And I'm curious what your speakers think about why it's different today. Why are the stakes different today? Thank you.
Lewis Wallace, what do you think is different about the Trump administration and the Obama or Bush or Clinton or Reagan administrations that preceded it?
Wow. Okay. I'm going to do a little bit of a dodge on that question because I'm just not sure that I'm the authority on what is different about the Trump administration. But something that I have been thinking about a lot is what is different about the media right now. And I think to sort of follow on what Laura was just talking about, you know, that that we're in something of a crisis as the mainstream media. When it comes to trust from the public. And so while I don't believe that we should take Trump's statements about the media personally, I think we should take them seriously in terms of kind of what the implications are for where people are getting news and information, because there was a lot of misinformation. There was a lot of quote unquote fake news, but also just sort of hype around things that aren't true, like birtherism, that fed into this election. And I'm not going to say that sort of stuff decided the election. I don't think anybody knows all the factors that decided the election, but that the presence of misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, fake news was a very significant force. And I think one of the reasons it was able to be so significant is because the fact-based, truth-based media doesn't totally have a handle on all that has changed in terms of media consumption online and news consumption online, and what we can do to regain and re-earn our credibility with people and make sure that people, as we're sort of doing this hard work that Laura referenced, continuing to do what we do, you know, just reporting truthfully and carefully about this administration, that that information is reaching people and that it's seen as credible. And I think that's on us, you know. And then I think the other sort of unique concern with this administration is kind of the open disdain for freedom of speech, which is something that I just believe we should take seriously.
And Laura Hazard-Owen, I mean, the Obama administration, for example, the White House Correspondents Association complained quite bitterly about lack of access to the president, particularly in the first term of his administration. I mean, White Houses throughout history have been sources of complaint from members of the press. Is the Trump administration, you know, significantly different in any regard to your reckoning?
I believe it is different, and I actually think that this question brings up something that I was wanting to talk about in relation to objectivity, which is when we were sort of trying to define what we mean by objectivity, I think one of the biggest pitfalls of what have sort of is thought of in journalism as objectivity is feeling the need to present both sides of an argument, even when one side is clearly has more facts, much more evidence behind it than the other side. I actually believe that's one of the reasons why you know, news organizations, especially during the campaign, had a lot of trouble at times reporting on the election, was that there were a lot of unusual circumstances here. For example, Trump did not do sort of what we would expect a traditional politician to do if he was, you know, caught, for example, in the Access Hollywood tape, if he was, you know, if it was revealed that he had told a lie, he tended to double down rather than sort of seeming ashamed, as we would normally expect a politician to be in that situation, as we saw in the Romney 47% tape, for example. And so I think that kind of relationship with the media just makes it harder, but even more important for us to say, okay, hey, what's going on here? Is this true? And if it's not, we need to say that it's not true. This is beyond, I believe, sort of typical politician spin. It's beyond the kind of access issues that reporters have complained about, as you mentioned, through many administrations. I believe it is that disdain for the media that Lewis mentioned, and this also the sort of clamping down on protest on First Amendment rights. I think that those are the sort of dangerous, scary issues here, and when we're confronting them, we need to call them out when they are scary and seem dangerous and seem different, and not just sort of be like, well, on the one hand, you know, on the other hand, you know, that's the kind of judgment, yeah, that I'm talking about journalists needing to apply.
Doesn't seem to me, at least, that there was any reticence to call things out throughout the campaign or even since the administration took office. I mean, it goes way back to Ronald Reagan 30, 35 years ago talking about the government is the problem, not the solution. And then that sort of morphed into figures like Sarah Palin coming up with, nicknames, the lamestream media, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what perhaps is different now is that the president himself is leading the charge for discrediting the media. So when the Billy Bush tape happens or when these various other things happen, when he disavows his longstanding position on the place of birth of Barack Obama, his supporters aren't moved one way or the other. They just don't care. Because if it's written about in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or reported on NPR, it's obviously not credible because the president has said so. So it's an interesting thing when the president himself is leading the charge to say, you can't trust anything you read. Perhaps all you can trust is the stuff I tweet. We will come back and talk more about this with Lewis Wallace. He's a freelance journalist and former reporter for Marketplace, which airs here on WYPR weekday evenings at 6:30. Laura Hazard Owen is the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall, our email midday@wypr.org. Glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Lewis Wallace, a freelance journalist, and Laura Hazard Owen, the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. Last month, Lewis was fired from his job as a reporter for Marketplace after publishing a blog post on Medium.com titled Objectivity is Dead, and I'm Okay with It. We're talking about the questions that Lewis Wallace raised in his post about the role of journalists in this era of alternative facts and the Trump administration. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780. Our email address here at Midday, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let me go to an email from Stephen, who says, I don't really need to know what a reporter's personal opinions are, but I do expect him or her to not let an interviewee get away with spin and or lies. When something is demonstrably and flagrantly wrong, any journalist should call the interviewee out and not let it go unchallenged, no matter how impolite it may seem. So Laura Hazard Owen, the other night when Kellyanne Conway talked about the Bowling Green massacre, Chris Wallace, or the guy who hosts Hardball, Chris Matthews was chided by some for not immediately saying, wait a minute, the Bowling Green massacre didn't happen. NBC News reported that Cosmopolitan magazine had quoted Kellyanne Conway saying that. TMZ had already in the past quoted and aired footage of Kellyanne Conway referring to this non-existent event allegedly perpetrated by Iraqi refugees. What do you think about that? I mean, is it incumbent upon us to call out people we're talking to, even in a live broadcast situation, on everything that they say that we feel is not true?
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely think that that is our responsibility, and that it's not something that we should describe as not feeling is not true. If something is not true, you know, it's not true, and we should call it out. That's really hard to do in real time. And I think that we are seeing journalists getting better at that as the Trump administration, gets into its, I don't know, this is third, fourth week. It takes a little practice, and it is really hard to sort of be able to, what did I just hear? Like, that doesn't sound right. And do that right at the time. But I think that it's something that we can prepare for, that interviewers should be prepared for, that they should be ready to do And then in addition to that, that, you know, in non-live reporting, so after the fact, that we need to, again, be telling, you know, readers if, for example, if there is no such thing as the Bowling Green Massacre, we need, you know, of course, need to say that.
Well, I know the first time I heard the term Bowling Green Massacre, I had never heard of it. So I had to look it up, you know, and that's when I figured out that it never happened. I thought, well, maybe this is something I forgot. I mean, it's difficult to be completely encyclopedic about everything that's, you know, happened or not happened. I mean, the Trump administration just last night or early this morning released a list of, I think it's 78 terrorist incidents that the president said had not been reported on. And these included the events in San Bernardino or Nice or in Paris. I mean, things that got enormous press coverage. I mean, it's just a blatant falsehood to suggest that the press didn't choose to report these things. But they have their list. And they're as you say, he's sort of doubling down on what he thinks the media has done.
I mean, one thing that you can always do, I agree that if the term Bowling Green Massacre just kind of flew by me in an interview, I might think that it sounded strange and I wouldn't necessarily be like, wait, that's not a thing. But you can, you know, you can, it's okay to ask in the moment. You can say, wait, what is the Bowling Green Massacre? Can you please tell me what, you know, what, tell our listeners what that is? You know, try to get them to explain to you. Try to get people to elaborate. I mean, I think that's a good journalistic technique in general for those ones where it's so impossible to be prepared for something that just kind of flew out of someone's mouth. Like, obviously, you can't be prepared for that in every situation. And then, you know, we also see that this administration has sort of repeatedly doubled down on certain claims that we keep seeing coming back, like inauguration, crowd sizes, and the popular vote and things like that. If we know that these things are going to keep coming up, you know, those ones, we can have the facts at sure. hand to rebut in real time.
And Lewis Wallace, before we get to another email or two, I want to talk to you about the importance of the fact that you are a trans person to this argument. Some folks have suggested that there is a choice that we can have impartiality or diversity in our newsrooms in America. That seems like a kind of a strange choice. Why can't we have both? And what is the fact that you are a trans person? How does that inform this conversation? And would it be different if you were a cis white male?
Yeah, well, I certainly don't think that anyone is sort of uniquely biased or uniquely partial as a result of being part of a marginalized community. But I think part of the reason why everyone's bias is so obvious to me is because of being coming at, from sort of an outsider perspective into a lot of things. So, you know, sort of a real life experience example for me is just I came out as trans a little over 15 years ago. So I was pretty young, and the context was also that there was very little media coverage of trans people at all, and where there was, it was often focused on kind of this idea that we were people with a mental illness or some sort of pretty severe problem. And so, you know, I see a ton of bias in that take on trans people, and that has the way the media has dealt with trans people has changed significantly as trans people have been activists and advocates on our own behalf and also entered into newsrooms. And now there's such a thing as a trans journalist. There wasn't really such a thing as a trans journalist when I came out as trans. And so I feel like what's transparent to me there is the bias kind of against the humanity and wholeness and complexity of trans people that has been transformed by increasing the diversity of newsrooms and the diversity of representation in stories. And now I see really complicated, great, interesting conversations happening in, you know, the New York Times or on NPR about transgender people. But that wasn't true not all that long ago. And so to me, that's the argument for in every area, constantly really put, that's a part of the argument for constantly really pushing to increase diversity and increase representation of lots of different kinds within newsrooms, because that it actually pushes back against biases that a newsroom that is not diverse might not even see that it has.
And Laura Hazard Owen, this notion that impartiality can only be maintained at the expense of diversity, what do you think about that? I mean, for example, what's your advice to journalists of color who are covering the Trump administration? And this is a guy who campaigned with some virulently racist and bigoted views. He tolerated racist and bigoted views from supporters to a certain extent. He almost encouraged, in some instances, violence against people of color at his rallies. That perspective from a person of color looking at the body politic, I would think, is extremely valuable. What's your advice to those reporters?
I mean, I really think that as the person who emailed and the person whose email you just read mentioned, it's not that we need to begin inserting ourselves into our personal opinions into every story. It's that I would really like to see us avoiding this sort of, on the one hand, sort of some say that Trump is, being bigoted when he X, Y, and Z. On the other hand, I would sort of like to get that on the one hand, on the other hand, out here. And I think that if news organizations are sort of enabling reporters to do that, then our reporting is just going to be better, and it's going to be more helpful to the people who are reading it. It is not the media's job to present two sides of an argument, no matter what the argument is. And I would argue that it is especially important not to do that when it comes to human rights, to the rights of American people. I think it's ridiculous to expect that that we should allow the viewpoint that, for example, that a person of color is inferior to a white person. I don't think that that's sort of an opinion, a side that we can treat as being equally valid. You know, the political center shifts over time, but we need to be decent human beings.
We have about a minute left here. Lewis Wallace, one of the things that came up was a discussion about whether or not journalists should have been allowed to attend the march that happened the day after the inauguration. There were certain newsrooms that strictly forbade it. Others were loose about it. But do you think people should have attended or should have been allowed to attend that march as private citizens if they weren't covering the event?
I think that depends a lot on the newsroom and on who their desired audience is, who their current audience is, and what their ethics policy is. And, you know, all of that is up for debate and should be. So we certainly have credible newsrooms right now, like Mike.com, that also allowed, you know, some of their journalists to go march in the Women's March. I don't have a take for any given organization on that other than to say that I think this is an excellent time to be asking those questions and opening up the possibility that those questions can be asked in a very open way by reporters without their credibility being questioned.
Well, Lewis Wallace, I appreciate your time today, and Laura Hazard Owen, yours as well. Thank you so much for this good conversation. It's a conversation that we will no doubt continue with you and others in and out of the field of journalism. So thanks to you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lewis Wallace is a freelance journalist and former reporter for American Public Media's Marketplace. Laura Hazard Owen is the deputy editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. We'll have links to relevant articles and more information on the web at wypr.org/midday. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation about the Department of Justice consent decree with the Baltimore Police Department. Last year, the DOJ investigated the BPD, found widespread bias and repeated examples of unconstitutional misconduct. So how does the Baltimore Police Department plan to clean up its act? And what will happen under the consent decree? Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun, Ganesha Martin of the Baltimore Police Department, and Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition will join me to talk about the current status and the future of the consent decree. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours can be found at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall for the entire Midday team. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.